This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 393 for September 29th, 2017. Talkin' Tiguan. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us. As you can hear from my voice, I'm not John. John's not here today, so I'm filling in as the host. But I come with great support here. We have Professor Scott Burgess, who
Professor Dr. Engineer,
who many of you remember as a longtime favorite of the show, and we've always enjoyed having him on. And now we have him back by popular demand.
Well, Scott, thank you very much for having me.
And you literally are Professor.
Well, I am teaching at Wayne State and also getting my PhD
in teaching journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So, very very legitimate.
Anyone work. Looking for interns? Let me know. I can send the most full supply of people.
Okay. Got Frank Marcus, Motor Trend. Now, I got to tell you that the last time that I saw Frank, he was down on his hands and knees looking under a replica of the Ed Roth Mysterion car.
Yes. I mean,
so this guy is
counting the drive shafts on that baby.
This guy's a serious engineering guy. Scott used to work with him. He knows, and we're glad to have you back, Frank.
Always a pleasure.
And so that was a great thing. And our very special guest today is Jeff Ng, yep, or Jeffrey, his mother would like us to say, who is the product manager for the VW Tiguan. And he brought a Tiguan to the studio for us. So,
yeah. Jeff, thanks for having me.
So I just figured that before we start asking you questions, just so we can get sort of a base level here. So the original Tiguan was actually shown for the first time in 2006 at the LA Auto Show as a concept vehicle. Mm-hmm. Came out as a production vehicle in 2007. It was a golf-based vehicle at the time. This is the most fascinating fun fact I was able to discover about it, that the name Tiguan is actually a combination of the German words for tiger, which apparently is tiger in German, and iguana, which is Lagan or something like that.
Right.
So Tiguan, that's where it came from. I guess there was a contest that a magazine ran, and that's where the name came from.
Right.
Fun fact to know and tell. Win bar bets with it.
Yep. It was auto built. There was actually 600,000 respondents.
What was number two?
The car got a facelift in 2011, and now there's the second generation vehicle. It's the first VW SUV based on the MQB platform and shown for the first time in production arraignment in 2015.
Well, actually, for the normal wheelbase, that's right. But in the U.S., I mean, the Atlas would be considered the first Volkswagen SUV on the MQB platform. But that's right, all new car, completely new. First thing you notice is it looks very different than the old car. Modern Volkswagen design language. And of course, you notice it is much larger than the first generation car.
And the first generation car continues because its biggest sales year was like, what, last year?
It was last year, 2016. Record year.
So this is 10.6 inches longer than the previous generation.
Right.
So why so much bigger?
Well, as Americans, we like our space. So, that's where the segment headed. You know, they're still compact SUVs, but they have grown significantly. From the very beginning of the concept phase, we knew we needed a larger Tiguan to compete in the segment. So that's what we did. And by adding that 10.5 inches to the car, it also allowed us to add a third row seat, which is very unique in the segment. So customers have that option.
So when we talk about the segment, what do you see constituting the segment? Who are your biggest competitors?
Well, biggest competitors, I mean, there's a well-entrenched competitors out there. So your Honda CR-V, RAV4, Ford Escape, these models have been around a long time. You know, they were the trendsetters for that segment, and they've over the years put together, you know, a formula that really works. But you know, they have been around a long time, and we think with the new Tiguan, we've done something unique and different. It's Volkswagen's take on a compact SUV, we think it's
and really, in terms of third row, you're really up against Rogue and Mitsubishi Outlander, pretty much, right?
Yeah, that's right. Those are pretty much the only two. And I mean, if you look at the Rogue, you know, this it's still a compact SUV, so the third row seat will only be used occasionally. But compared to the Rogue third seat, I mean, I think this is a lot more usable.
Mm-hmm. Now, so is this version of the Tiguan only available in the U.S. or is this an international product?
It's an international product, and they're all built. The long wheelbase Tiguans are all built in Puebla or in China, and then the Chinese built ones are obviously just for the Chinese market. But it's going to around 80 countries. In the European market, it is the Tiguan Allspace because they also have the normal wheelbase Tiguan. But yeah, it's a lot of markets.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think it's going to sell the best? In the U.S., or is this too big for the Europeans?
The largest market, for sure, for the long wheelbase will be the U.S. Yeah.
So in developing something like this, okay, what are some of the factors that you, as the product manager here in the U.S., say, hey, we've got to have this, the other guys have it, we've got to have it, we've mm-hmm. got to overachieve here? I mean, just give some of the factors that you thought were
Well, some of the basic things you need, of course, are just the usability and the versatility of the vehicle. So one of that is space. And then if you think how people are going to use this car, it's, you know, oftentimes there will be more than one person in the car. So you want the second row to have plenty of space, and you want it to be comfortable. Our second row slides forward and back 7 inches. The back seat also reclines, and there is a ton of space back there. In addition to that, the interior is just really great. I mean, it's somewhere where the new Tiguan shines. The panoramic sunroof is just huge. I mean, the glass goes back all the way above the heads of those in the second row. And then we've also added some ambient lighting on the side of that just to make it a really nice ambiance inside. So there's the basic stuff, versatility and space. And you think about how people are going to use the car. So, you know, having a power lift gate makes it really easy to load stuff in the back. But then we made sure from even the base car that we have levers in the trunk area to fold down the second row. So just things that make people's life easier. But then, you know, what's above and beyond what's unique for us is, of course, it's a Volkswagen. So it has to be fun. It has to be fun to drive. It has to be fun to be in. And part of that is, of course, the driving dynamics, which MQB platform, all of those cars, you know, have strong driving dynamics. The new Tiguan does too.
So what are some of the other cars?
The Atlas, which a large car for the platform, but still drives, you know, it drives smaller than it actually is. But then the Audi TT, the Golf, and the Audi S3, A3, all on the MQB platform.
You'd be the only one who knew that other than Jeff, I think.
Maybe.
It's soon to be everything, though.
Yes.
Everything transverse engine.
Yes. But, you know, you're talking about cargo. I mean, so as viewers know, I often cite numbers, and it is pretty impressive. So if you have a three-row model, you've got 33 cubic feet behind the third row, and then if you fold that down...
Behind the second row.
Okay.
Okay. Too much behind the third.
Right. I was going to say.
And then 65.7 if you fold the second row. So huge back there. And
right.
Then the two-row models, 37.6 cubic feet behind the rear seats and 73.5 cubic feet in all.
Right.
So you can have a lot of stuff.
Yep, so that's right up there at the top of the segment.
So what kind of families do you think are buying the third row? Because let's face it, that is a pretty much for children. I mean, if we push the middle seat all the way forward, I can physically get back there, but my head's all down like this and my knees are all up like that. So it's not really ever for an adult person. So is it really young families, or what do you think?
Well, I think the customers will be pretty much what the segment is. So it's pretty bimodal. You have young couples, they may have young kids, and then you also have the other side of the spectrum. You have your baby boomers. Kids can fit back there. It's kind of, you know, say someone drops off their kid at soccer practice, and when they pick them up, you know, another kid needs a ride home, and
it's a carpool
you have that. Yeah. You know, you don't need to.
You don't go on vacation with that seat filled, but you run carpool with it.
You may not plan to take a cross-country trip, but it's nice to have that flexibility in the cases that you can use it.
So to go back to the panoramic sunroof, is this best-in-class sort of thing that you guys went after with this?
It's definitely a strong point for us. There's a few others that have pretty large panoroofs too, but it's something even in the first generation Tiguan, which was very popular with customers. I mean, we heard a lot of praise for that sunroof, and it's something that sets the Tiguan apart. Some in the segment, some of the leaders actually don't even have a panoramic sunroof. They just have a regular size sunroof.
Mm-hmm. What about the powertrain?
Powertrain, this is a new generation 2-liter four-cylinder engine. It's what we call the B-cycle engine. So it's the only car with this engine, or the first car with this engine. It has 184 horsepower and 221 pound-feet of torque.
So the B-cycle being the
Budok.
So this was after an engineer that works?
Engineer at Volkswagen that developed this engine.
Frank, can you explain what this is?
Not in the time allotted here.
Okay. I just thought, you know. Although, Scott, you could take a shot at it.
But, no.
So you get 184 horsepower, 221 pound-feet of torque.
Not a ton of those numbers aren't real big if you fill up all the seat belts. We were kind of concerned that might be a little, you know, on the low end of acceptable in a vehicle. Because it is a pretty big car.
It is a big car. Yeah, so we went down on horsepower, but it's at 184 horsepower, it's completely in line with the segment. But then the 221 is really competitive for the segment.
So all of the vehicles have start-stop systems.
Yes.
And so you guys were paying attention to fuel economy. Is that one of the factors that plays into the B-cycle engine?
Definitely. I mean, the Budok cycle, the basis of it is fuel efficiency.
So being an SUV, you also have all manner of all-wheel drive capability. And I got to explain this one to me. So you guys have, you can equip this car with 4Motion with active control all-wheel drive system. What is that? Mm-hmm.
So the 4Motion system is what's new about it for both the Atlas and the new Tiguan is we now have this active control dial right by the gear shift. And what this does is allows the driver to select different driving modes. And so there's 4 modes. There's on-road, which you'll keep just in normal driving. Then you have a snow mode, an off-road mode, and then off-road customizable. And for snow mode and for off-road, the car sets all the different driving systems to optimize it for those conditions. So, for example, in snow mode, the traction control system will change, so it allows a little bit more slip in a straight line, but then when it senses you're going around a curve, it goes to a more lower threshold, so the traction control will kick in sooner. So it changes the braking system, the powertrain, your steering weight, changes a lot of things to optimize the performance and traction.
Do you have to use the dial, or can you just drive it and it has sensors that...
4Motion is always active.
Okay.
Default, it's front-wheel drive, just in normal road conditions. Within fractions of a second, it can send 100% of the torque to the wheel that has traction. But what the active control dial does is, you know, it's not just detecting slip. It's actually, if you know you're driving through snow, you put it into snow mode, and then you have that extra capability for other systems, not just the traction control, not just for motion.
Yeah, like in sand, we tested it on our SUV of the year testing, which results are not out yet. I can't break any embargoes here. But
wait till your January issue of Motor Trend.
Exactly, January issue. But in sand, quite often you want a little bit more wheel spin, and it will allow that kind of thing to keep mm-hmm. you going and so forth.
Snow as well. I mean,
yeah, both.
And I would imagine that you studied everyone else's systems, the terrain response on a Land Rover, or and everyone has something like this. Since this is the newest version, what did you guys do to make it a little bit different, or what did you improve upon?
Oh, for the car overall?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned the size. That's a big thing for an improvement over the old car. But if you go to the interior, just the fit and finish is very nice. The quality of materials we use, our infotainment system is probably one of the best in the segment in terms of usability and what you can do.
Virtual cockpit.
We have on the top trim, we have a Volkswagen digital cockpit available, the 12.3-inch digital instrument screen, high resolution, very nice. And then our center screen for our infotainment, it's an 8-inch screen. And it's very bright. It's a capacitive touchscreen. It's very sensitive. Almost, I mean, you'll feel like you're using your iPad. It's really great.
And the whole thing looks like a black glass, like
right.
modern.
Very gives it a very very modern design. Mm-hmm. And then of course, I mean, the whole interior is classic Volkswagen. So ergonomics are excellent. It's not, you know, there's not too many buttons. It's easy to operate and to figure out.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back. We have some questions from the audience that we'll be asking you. Okay. So we're going to hear a message from our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. Okay, so Mike from San Francisco, California says, VW announced that they're planning a new fleet of vehicles, all that will be emissions-free or electric. Will any of the current vehicles, like the Tiguan, exist then, or will this be a collector's item in the making?
Well, certainly the direction of the industry is towards electric, and I think you know, our executives have laid out, to some degree, our plans for electrification. And those cars will be all new. I mean, we've seen some of the concept cars already out there. You look at what was at Frankfurt. So there's going to be a lot of new and exciting cars out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dave Goldberg from Lake Zurich, Illinois, wants to know, does VW have any plans to provide upgraded engine options for the Tiguan or boost the output of the current power plant?
There's no current plans, but we're always looking at how we can improve the car to include the powertrain.
And a VR6 certainly fits in there, right?
There's space.
Okay, and he also wants to know, will the Type R trim have any performance boost or suspension upgrades?
What we'll have is an R-line package, but it's not a performance-based package. It's mostly a styling package, so there's a lot of exterior trim will be different, the front and rear bumper, the wheels, and then some details on the inside also.
And you may not know this, maybe you know this, I'm not sure, I certainly don't know this, maybe you
I
know
don't.
This, but Hilton says, seeing the letters AAH, auto line after hours, in the title reminds me of an engine code of a VW engine which also had the same letters AAH. I think it was the 1.6 Golf Jetta engine. Anybody?
Not quite enough room up here for
no.
that level of minutia that far back.
You had to do too much traveling.
Yeah, they've been written over. Some of that memory has been written over.
you remember? No, you don't remember anything like that. And you know, so Do you see, I mean, so obviously, you know, you're sort of biased towards crossovers, I would suspect, given the fact that this is your baby here. I mean, do you see the trend line going for sedans down and CUVs up as we go into the future?
I think we've already seen that. I think 2015 was the first year where SUVs sold more than sedans. So we see that as a trend. People are coming out of sedans and going into SUVs. I mean, SUVs now, you really don't have to sacrifice anything compared to what you had in sedans. You get the added benefit of, you know, higher ride heights and more capability, more space without the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. And is this primarily a U.S. phenomenon, or when you go and visit with your colleagues around the world, are they seeing the same sorts of things?
I would say it's I don't know the numbers in other markets, but I would say it's mostly the U.S. You know, in Europe, wagons are still popular. So, you know, as soon as you build a, you know, if you, the old Tiguan, you had a wagon type vehicle and you raise it up and it becomes an SUV.
Mm-hmm. So why do you guys think, I mean, this interesting notion of wagons not doing very well in the U.S. market, and yet, you know, if you go to Europe, as you say, that, I mean, how many wagons does Volkswagen have over there? I mean, it's just zillions. But what do you think accounts for that?
It's largely, I think people want to see over traffic. They want a higher H point, and, you know, wagons are just these lower down. So, yeah, I think that's one of the bigger problems.
And I would have been happy to answer this in, you know, 2013. The one thing I think that we've seen is that the customers and all of us have finally accepted that you can have a car-based platform and it be a CUV. That CUVs and SUVs all fall into that same category now. And before, we used to have that distinct line of body-on-frame trucks that were SUVs and cars. And now all of that is blurred together. So what makes up a car? I mean, look at the difference between an Impreza and a Crosstrek. It's the same thing. It's just slightly, one is higher.
Mm-hmm.
And as Frank mentioned, you know, people like the riding height. I think ingress egress is a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's CUVs are easier to get in and out of. Europeans, they'll slowly move into a lot of those really small crossovers. Those are really popular. Yeah, wagons are still a big deal, but they're moving into more CUVs, especially this becomes too big, I think, for a lot of places in Europe. But the first size Tiguan was a really nice family car. Gas mileage, now that CUVs get car gas mileage,
mm-hmm.
if you can have more space.
So Scott sort of brings up an interesting point here. And you were talking about the ability to have snow, sand, on-road, off-road. I mean, is this meant to be an off-road vehicle, or is this basically meant to be an on-road vehicle that in the event that you somehow find yourself off-road, you can get back on the road?
It's meant to be, you know, what most SUVs are in the U.S. market. I mean, we know very small percentage is actually going to take it off-road to any sort of difficulty. So it's more capability on road in varying conditions.
Mm-hmm.
It supports those active lifestyles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had the opportunity to drive this at a like a rock quarry setting out near Jackson, Michigan, and it wasn't like, you know, the Rubicon Trail or anything, but I mean, it was the sort of thing that you wouldn't expect a nice-looking car like this to be able to deal with. I mean, and that was surprising, but I suspect that there'd be, like, I don't know, three or four people.
I think the most off-road thing it's going to do is a two-track to your cabin,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe a gravel road someplace,
right?
If you're out by Chelsea.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, I don't think people have that expectation that they're going to ever do. I think that they'll get the false sense of, when they're on the snow, like they can do something that they shouldn't be able to do, and they won't be able to because they don't have snow tires.
Mm-hmm.
But
and physics are physics.
Yeah. Right, so. But, I mean, lots of cars can do a lot of stuff. I mean, all this just gives you additional height.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a little more clearance.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's not trail rated.
Mm-hmm. So this has been on the market now for a short period of time. It's clearly gaining some adherence. I mean, what's the reaction that you're hearing from customers? Are they surprised? Are they people who used to own Tiguans who are getting their second one? Are they people who are coming out of other products and getting into this? And how do they feel about it?
You're right. Well, it launched the end of July, early August. We've kind of only had one full month, or almost September will be kind of the real full month of sales. And then we also had some issues with the hurricane and getting supply out there. But what we hear from customers so far is, you know, a lot of them were either previous Tiguan owners, or they liked the Tiguan, there just wasn't space. So now they're like, finally, the Tiguan has enough space and I can consider it for purchase. So I think it's a mix of both. It's people that always liked the Tiguan, and if you had the old Tiguan, if you had the previous generation, those people really loved the car. I mean, that it was almost like a cult following to some degree. So they're excited about the new car, but then there's this, and this is, you know, what we were hoping for, a whole new customer base that now can consider the car because it meets all of their needs.
You're not getting backlash from people that really love the original Tiguan, and they're like, what the hell did you do? Why is this thing so huge?
Well, like I said, they're somewhat of a cult following, so of course there are those people, and we hope we can, you know, at some time in the future address those concerns.
Hashtag, you know, small Tiguan.
This is a great car that I think they would still be happy with if they loved the previous generation.
So how is the previous generation Tiguan sized in comparison to the T-Roc, which European model car?
The T-Roc is smaller than the previous generation Tiguan. Yeah, and it also sits lower. So it's more, I think, Mazda CX-3, mm-hmm. that type of size.
So I'm not sure if this is a comment or a question. There's an exclamation point at the end, so it's probably a comment. Right Knight 70 puts, Sabertooth Tiguan with over 400 HP and a rear-wheel biased all-wheel drive system, exclamation point. I guess perhaps he wants one of those.
I would love that.
You would love that?
I would love that,
you,
too.
You wouldn't want to count on a big business case for that one.
Yeah. And would the engine fit? Yeah, I mean, it's... What's the transmission in this, by the way? We didn't.
It's an 8-speed automatic.
Uh-huh. So you guys basically checked all the boxes in terms of size.
Size and then...
Powertrain.
Yeah, and I mean this...
Capacity.
Another unique thing about this car is it has the best SUV warranty in the U.S. 6 years, 72,000 miles. So buy with confidence.
Buy early.
Are all Volkswagens move into that?
Right now it's just SUVs.
Just SUVs?
Yeah.
And you guys are a little bit late to the SUV party. I mean, you had the Touareg for a long time. But, I mean, we saw, I don't know how many Atlases or versions of the Atlases at car shows, you know, that the yeah. next big SUV coming, next big. But, I mean, you certainly have a very good combination of them now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, that's why it's an exciting time right now at Volkswagen to have, you know, fresh off the heels of the Atlas hitting the market in early summer, we have, you know, another SUV right behind it. So it's exciting for us.
All right, final and loaded question. Why should someone buy a Tiguan rather than an Atlas?
Well, if they, it's all about size.
I would ride across country in the third row of an Atlas.
Yeah.
Comfortably and happily.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be all
nope,
contorted.
There's oodles of room back there. Mm-hmm. Easy to get in and out. Mm-hmm. Whole different thing.
Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for large-ish, efficient size with capability.
Although even there, I'm hoping for that 3-liter twin-turbo VR6 from China.
In that?
In the Atlas.
Oh, in the Atlas.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and this would be even better, but...
I was gonna say that... So you've got a interesting vehicle here on your hands, which I think you should probably be fairly happy to have and put on the market here.
What do you move on to next then?
Well, we have some plans for the future, but we'll have to wait and see how that materializes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, we want to thank you for coming.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And Certainly wish you all the best of luck with this. It's as you said earlier, it's a very, very competitive segment, and you know, I think as Frank probably, who has driven all of these things recently, knows, hard not to crack, but good luck.
So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Okay, so we'll be back. We'll be talking with Scott and Frank about various and sundry subjects, but first we're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, and we are back. So, there's some interesting news this week. Apparently this week, Amazon rolled out with all new manner of their Echo devices, and BMW took the opportunity to announce that all BMW and Mini models from mid-2018 will be equipped with Alexa, Amazon's voice-controlled personal assistant. And, you know, and I started thinking about that. It's just like, I thought BMWs were the ultimate driving machine.
Not for a couple of years.
Okay, so explain.
Yeah, I mean, we're very dismayed that there's an awful lot of this kind of distraction going on over at BMW. It seems like more and more, you know, cars that we drive from them are like, where's the steering wheel we liked in the good old days? And where's, you know, a lot of things, there's a lot of distracting forces in the auto industry generally. And maybe they just said, well, pretty soon it's all automated anyway. Who cares about the ultimate driving machine at that point? Let's just start working in that direction. I don't know, but it saddens some of us a little bit.
I mean, so, it's nice if you need to order spare parts.
All right, so Dieter May, Senior Vice President, Digital Services and Business Models at the BMW Group. That's quite a title. Digital Services and Business Models, all in one. Said, and I quote, "By making this step of integrating Alexa into our models from mid-2018, BMW and Mini will form a more intrinsic part of our customers' digital lifestyles." Okay, do people buy cars, Scott, because of their digital lifestyles, or do they buy cars for transportation, or do they buy cars because they have some intrinsic love of cars? Or, I mean, is this all changing?
Well, it is changing, and it may be because as we're looking towards automation and things that people will need to be able to do other things inside their car other than drive. I don't like Alexa at home. I certainly wouldn't want it in my car. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we won't even get into all the data it collects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Scary.
So customers can find out which movies are currently showing at the local cinema, listen to their favorite playlist, or find out the weather at their destination by voice command while on the move. And if the driver realizes midway through a journey that they have forgotten something, they can ask Alexa to place an online order. Does this mean that, you know, their Amazon will deliver it by drone
They are working out ways of delivering things to your car with a, you know, uplink. This is, okay, the delivery thing is here. Pop the trunk. Okay, it's back in. Lock it back down again. Okay. I guess.
I'm going to have to wrap my car in aluminum foil now.
to keep them from, you know, the thing, you know, Frank, you guys are driving, like, everything at Motor Trend. And, you know, the thing that sort of strikes me is that more and more car companies seem to be emphasizing if they have Apple CarPlay or Google or Alexa why is this?
Well, I mean, millennials are nothing if not connected. And if they get disconnected, they get discombobulated. And so, you know, going forward, as they, you know, ramp up in the car buying demographics, that kind of thing is really important. It's funny to me when you see BMW, which an awful lot of their cars are very expensive, and therefore old people are buying them, mm-hmm. you know, with they have the means. And the least likely to be Alexa-ing, you know, turning their house on from the car and all that stuff, which
right.
is what that's all about. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there. But, I mean, that's only temporary. You know, and as time goes on, the number of connected people in the universe of the Luddites is going to mm-hmm. switch over. But, yeah, I don't know. Some of us just wish they didn't take their eye completely off of the ball of the
right.
what used to make cars great. Mm-hmm.
The merging of the information superhighway and the regular highway seems to be complete now. I think it's a lot of it is not just customers' demands, but it's how car makers want to be viewed by young people. That it's not a car company. That's dirty manufacturing. They want to, you know, I mean, when Mark Fields was still at Ford, we saw that just endlessly. You know, I don't know what they were, a transportation.
Mobility
innovator.
Services provider.
I mean, you make cars, so make cars that are good.
But does it matter as much as having Android Auto?
I'm fine without Android Auto.
But do you think that people in the industry, the car companies, look at the landscape and say, hey, if we don't have this, no one's going to buy our car.
Yes, and that is getting to be the, you know, power locks. If you don't have Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, like Toyota. Toyota is in a kind of a pissing match with Apple, especially. I think maybe not as much Android. With what do you do with the information that comes out of the car? Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of assurances can you give us that information isn't going somewhere we don't like? And they don't want to give that information up. And so your new Camry, your new electric architecture and everything has Scout GPS, mm-hmm. which is not as good as CarPlay or Android Auto. And they're taking hits for it in every review of these new generation of cars. That every time a new car comes out without those two things, people go, what happened here?
So in the case of, say the Camry, and so because they have a proprietary system, that people won't say, I'm using my phone anyway?
Oh.
I mean, it's the thing I wonder about. I mean, it's just like, remember when they used to, like, physically install phones in cars? I mean, it would just be on the the transmission hump, that'd be like bolted down, and it's because that was what the future would be.
I don't know why I still can't just plug my phone in and see my phone on the center console.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I would want. I could pull up Waze and drive fast.
Right.
For a long time, I think it was the car makers. They made a lot of money on that center console, that stereo unit, that all of those things. They get a lot of money. And so, when you would get navigation, it was a $1,500 download that was easy cash.
Mm-hmm. Was or is?
Well, now somebody else is making that money. Now Waze makes the money off of you using it, not
right.
Wait, how did they, I ever paid them a dime?
Well, they get data and they sell it.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's still what I would like today is just plug my phone in. That way, when I get out of the car, my phone is charged,
right.
And I just use my phone. Mm-hmm. And you could put certain limitations on it, that you can't text.
Actually, I just saw the new Kia, I think it was the Kia Stinger, has one USB point that is clearly identified as the one that's going to inform the screen, mm-hmm. and the other one that's just for charging.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to run Waze, which burns the battery down while you're on the screen the whole time, and you don't want it connected to the, because then all of a sudden you can't listen to the radio or whatever,
right.
So there, some people are recognizing that, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of things that are of a technical nature, so the aforementioned Toyota, the Toyota Research Institute came out yesterday and showed their platform 2.1, which it seemed rather astonishing to me that they were showing level 4/5 capabilities in these vehicles, and they're taking this route where they're having it's either the guardian function, which means that you can drive your car, and then if something goes awry as you're driving, the car will take over, or the chauffeur function, which will chauffeur you. So as we're seeing companies like Toyota do this and as well as others, I mean, is that going to become a point of differentiation for car companies?
I'll tell you, I have stopped caring about the technical advances that make these things possible because I have complete and total faith that they will come around. What I am paying attention to now is where are we on the legal landscape here? I just recently had a chance to drive in Traffic Jam Pilot, the Audi A8, which is the first, honest to God, level 3 system where the driver must be able to take over with a 10-second warning or whatever. which is fully functional. It's in there. It's ready to go to production. It's not legal any place on Earth at the moment, but it's very close in Germany. And so they're working with the various powers that be over there to raise the limit from 10 kilometers an hour where autonomy is allowed, which is for parking, for self-parking cars, to 60, which would be kilometers an hour, traffic jam speeds. Mm-hmm. We are not very close to that at all over here. So good for them. Great. I mean, I really think getting people to figure out how to get the redundancies and all that kind of thing, I have faith that we're going to get that done. And I know that people will die in those cars, and that will be unfortunate, but there will be way, way, way fewer of them than are dying with idiots driving around, manually driving now. So mm-hmm. I think we'll all be willing to. But first thing is let's see how the legal thing goes here. When is it going to be possible to have autonomy here?
So do you think that the technologists will exceed the legislators in terms of having the fully baked capability to do some of these things?
They have to, yeah. I mean, Gary, I rode in my first autonomous car, and it was basically, stop and start cruise control with lane centering in 1993, I think. Mm-hmm. So this is, we've been working on this a long, long time. It's the legal thing. In New York, there's a law on the books that says you must always have one hand on the wheel. Well, that one's going to have to go if we're going to have, mm-hmm. Any sort of dream of autonomy of cars without steering wheels. What do you do then? Mm-hmm. So there's, we've already, I think the House has passed legislation that at least says the federal government is going to, have precedence over the states in this area, and it has to be reconciled with the Senate. That's not step one. That it lets us start going in that direction. But I mean, there's so many steps yet that, I'm just not worrying about it.
I've always said lawyers are going to, stop autonomous cars long before the engineering capabilities will be there. And then the other question you really have with autonomous vehicles is there's still going to be how many millions of vehicles that are not autonomous on the road at the same time? Because unless you ban all of those, and that would never happen.
See, it always occurred to me that if you were in an autonomous car and I was in a non-autonomous car and Frank was in a semi-autonomous car, that the autonomous car would be able to deal with the lesser life forms.
I believe we'll get to a point where, yes, you can still drive your manual-driven cars, but it's going to have a transponder on it that just says, here I am, here I am, here I am, so that all the vehicle-to-vehicle cars know where it is. And if someone just goes ramming around at high speed, everyone will know to get out of the way. They'll know, they'll see it coming. We'll have something like that in that interim period, mm-hmm. I believe.
Mm-hmm. But it seems that like lots of big money is being bet on autonomy. I mean, Baidu, the Chinese company, just came out with a $1.5 billion fund that they're going to be working with companies to develop autonomous capabilities. And earlier this year, they announced a giant, like a 10 times bigger project and got signed on by a variety of suppliers and OEMs to go to their system. And, and we're seeing NVIDIA and Google and on and on and on. I mean, it's just like, are these fool's bets or are they going to pay off?
You'll see autonomy first on the highways where it's a little more controlled, where you can drive across the state of Montana and never touch your steering wheel, and then
you can almost do that now.
Yeah,
a lot of the roads are really straight,
and you'll drive, and then we'll see kind of bus routes and the like things like that. Like the airport shuttle could be autonomous. And
my question is, of Baidu's 1. however many billion, how much of that is for lobbyists that can get the thing done on the legal side? Because that's where we need to be plowing some money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, we're going to take another break. Then we're going to come back. We've got plenty more to talk about and get you guys all agitated and talking about these things. So we're going to hear a word from our friends at Hyundai. And we are back. This week, Ford announced that it was going to begin working with Lyft in developing what? Autonomous capabilities. Now, it had always been my sense that General Motors was the company that was working with Lyft. And now we have, you know, the crosstown rival working with Lyft. Is this whole phenomenon going to change the competitive landscape, you know, not merely from, as we were saying earlier, you know, you don't have Android Auto or not buying your damn car, but competitive landscape from the point of view of people are going to come to this realization that in order to get to this bright, shiny future, we're going to have to start working with companies that our competitors are working with in ways that has never really been done before?
Short answer is, I think, yeah. I mean, they developed automatic transmissions together. That they've got a history of collaborating on,
right,
on something that the execution of it can be, you know, mm-hmm, distinguished at the customer level.
Right. What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, I agree. And doing anything with Lyft is probably smart because nobody wants to do anything with Uber.
Yeah.
We are seeing a backlash right now against a lot of these services. So that's also interesting. You know, places, London just banned them. Other cities, are, you know, around the country are also getting rid of some of them. And mm-hmm, then Uber has been self-destructing for the last year.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned London. I was just on vacation in London this past week. And what I thought was very interesting is that many of the classic black cabs have painted on the sides GETT, the G-E-T-T, which is basically the ride-hailing company that Volkswagen owns part of. And I thought, how very odd that they're banning you know, Uber for being Uber, and yet there's this, you know, these other ride.
I think they didn't ban the ride sharingness of them. I think there were some legitimate beefs about the way things were handled over there that don't necessarily mean that, you know, everybody else would be thrown out for the same reason. Don't you know?
It was, yeah, background checks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so according to Transport for London, they said that Uber was not, and I quote, sufficiently fit and proper. So they were, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
That is a real problem like that. Sort of speaking in that same category, we have a question here from AG. Do you guys think Ford's focus on mobility is probably the reason they didn't get to fix the PowerShift DCT, which hurt their small car sales in many markets?
I doubt you can draw a dotted line there, frankly.
No, but the DCT was very, very crappy.
So it didn't matter what it was. They just...
I thought it was to spur manual sales.
Okay. Alexander says, I saw that JLR wants to buy a luxury brand. My first question is, what brand would be a viable candidate, if any? Also, wouldn't it make more sense for them to scoop up a smaller mainstream brand like Mazda? I sort of thought that Jaguar and Land Rovers were luxury brands.
Aston Martin? Well, you know, I don't know.
I think they're probably doing too well and they'd be too expensive now, and they're well connected with... when that came out, too, I was kind of thinking, scratching my head and going, what in the world company would they... Who are they thinking about?
Mm-hmm.
All the big names, because you think, well, okay, they're concerned that, you know, we can only charge $170,000 for an autobiography, you know, and how do we get the $200,000 point, you know, and we need another brand name to do that, and all the ones that kind of do are really solidly hooked up and not really looking to change dance partners. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, would it be more luxurious than what Jaguar and Land Rover already are?
Yeah, so it's... sort of puzzles me, you know. And to the point of Mazda, I mean, there was that announcement this week that Mazda, Denso, and Toyota are now going to begin working, and they've started a separate company to develop electric vehicles. And the interesting thing is that Denso owns 5%, Mazda owns 5%, and Toyota owns 90%. I mean, I've got to believe that Toyota is going to absorb Mazda in the not too distant future. What do you guys think?
I hope not.
I really hope not too. They are such a plucky little group. You know, I mean, I've followed homogeneous charge compression ignition engines for years. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has done, you know, SAE papers and then, you know, all given up and walked away. They just quietly come out and they're going to have one next year in the Mazda 3. You know, you think these guys managed to do stuff that, you know, is pretty cool. And if they get absorbed by some giant company, God knows what happens to them.
So the new company will be named EV Common Architecture Spirit Company Limited. How's that for?
Looks like Toyota's in charge of the naming.
The new company will engage in the following: one, research into the characteristics, common architecture that define optimum performance and functions of EVs from the standpoint of both individual components and the whole vehicle; two, verification of component installation and vehicle performance realized by the characteristics achieved in one; and finally, examination of the optimum concept for each car classification with regard to each component and each type of vehicle realized by achieving items 1 and 2, okay? Which basically seems to me that lawyers wrote this press release. But what's interesting is that it said they're going to combine the strengths of each company, and, of course, Denso, big electronic supplier, so that's in part of the Toyota Keiretsu, as I recall, right? And here's the Mazda thing. Mazda's bundled product planning and prowess in computer modeling-based development. And then Toyota brings in its Toyota New Global Architecture. But so it sounds like they want to use the plucky Mazda, you know, can-do-it attitude.
Yeah.
So
I mean, Toyota had a big interest in Tesla at one point, did they not? I mean,
yeah.
That was a pretty good outfit to work with on electric cars, no? I mean,
they had those RAV4 EVs rolling around with the Tesla battery packs in there.
I mean, it's not a bad combination. Built by Toyota, you know, but, I don't know, Dynamics by Mazda from the marketing side. But at the end of the day, either one of those things win. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get both of those things. You don't get all of the great reliability and all of that, you know, kind of staid design, though, you know, they are getting more exciting.
You don't think Akio's going to change that?
No.
He's a race guy, right? I mean, all right. So while we're on this vector, Jonathan Willis via Twitter said, Mazda after the Ford divorce. What do you think? Prospered, not prospered? Done things that no one would have expected.
They've done really well, I think.
Yeah. I'm trying to. I don't know how much money they're making. They seem to plateau on that sales level, but they've done some incredible things with lightweighting. The whole Sky Active program is remarkable. Like when the new MX-5 came out, to pull out 200-300 pounds out of that car is incredible.
And in every category in which they compete, they are at least top three in terms of driving dynamics. Mm-hmm. The most fun, we love them, you know, over and over. They win comparison tests, you know, continuously, which is pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. So
they're doing all right, except for, you know, the thing that I often wonder about is that, you know, if you compare that to, like, any other mainstream manufacturer, the mainstream manufacturer has economies of scale that these guys can't touch, yet somehow they're able to do interiors
and I haven't studied this, but I've been told that their retention isn't great either for some reason. So
that people buy them and move on to something else.
Yeah, they're always trying to get the people in the door, and I don't know why that is, but... Mm-hmm.
So, okay, switching gears slightly, and no gears involved in this. So Sir James Dyson, of vacuum cleaner fame, has come out and said that in a couple of years that there's going to be a Dyson electric vehicle.
Exactly, a couple of years, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Rechargeable, too.
And not only it's a solid-state battery. Which has zero, no one has made one of those yet. Mm-hmm. So they're going to develop a solid-state battery technology they're buying.
They bought Sake.
Yeah.
I think that's
They're licensing the technology from them. And make up a whole car and produce it. You know, he needed to talk to Sergio Marchionne, who I think once said, if you're just anyone thinking about entering the car business, I'd tell it to lie down and wait until the feeling passes. You know?
Well, and he said that they just wouldn't make an ordinary automobile. They don't need to make an ordinary automobile. It'll be an extraordinary automobile. Now think about this. So they make the fans without blades, right? They're just those circular things that somehow cooled air comes out or heated air comes out. They've got the hand drying devices.
The miracle vacuum cleaner,
And the vacuum cleaner. And so I sort of think that if there's any company on Earth that can really take it to Tesla, it would be Dyson. Because basically you have more of a mass market brand with at least people are familiar with, like, gee whiz, I'm stuck with this Hoover. I really wish I could buy a Dyson sort of thing, right? I mean, so you've got that familiarity. It's got, you know, if they're able to do the same sort of design that they've done with the fans and with the vacuum cleaners, you know, you can see the guts of the vacuum cleaner and on and on and on, that I think that they could possibly win if they have a product.
Yeah, I just, the hubris of even saying that with this outside voice, we're going to develop a car in 2 years. Now, maybe they've been working on it for six, and it's been a skunk works, and no one's known about it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, and in which case, all right, maybe. But, I mean, dreaming up the whole thing from scratch, I mean, and then maybe he's going to have Magna build it. I mean, I don't know, there may be a bunch of things that make it viable that we haven't learned yet, mm-hmm. but the notion of developing a car with an unproven new battery and developing an assembly plant and coming out with this thing in 2 years and 3 months or whatever, I think it's just, you know.
I think they've been working on it. I think they just announced it. I think that, you know, given all of the, you know, what was it, BMW is going to come out with 12 electric vehicles between 2019 and 2025.
They're already a car company.
And Mercedes is going to have 10 between 2020 and 20. It's just like, okay, you know, everybody into the pool. We're all going to have electric cars now.
You know, are they as naive as Tesla was when they first came out? And then they're like, you know, product testing is hard. You know, testing a vacuum is one thing. Testing a car is a much different thing.
Right.
Durability testing is hard. And that was some of those big hiccups that Tesla ran into when it first came out. And it took them, 10, 12 years, really,
But they were never a consumer products company. I think that's the difference.
Yeah.
That at least these guys understand that, you know, there are customers out there, and they have certain expectations, and they're not going to necessarily be self-forgiving if you're thing bricks on them right away. But we'll see. When, you know, we'll be back here in 2020. We'll discuss the Dyson Mobile.
Yeah.
Mike at San Francisco, California says, Bob Lutz suggests that General Motors get into the autonomous vertical takeoff and landing business, as this makes as much sense. Maybe this is probably wrong. Suggests that General Motors getting into the autonomous VTOL business, as this makes as much sense as GM going into the fighter jet business when there are already companies in the military sector.
All right, he was talking about the taxi, the autonomous flying taxi business.
So they should
because
get into it, or they
should? They should.
Okay.
He said it's, Lutz is on record saying that, you know, the car companies should be mobility providers and should be looking at all those mobility things. They build all the taxi cabs now, and if taxi cabs all migrate to these, you know, scaled up drones, then they'll be left sitting on the sidelines out of that business. Maybe. And, of course, Mercedes, he was referring, the whole thing was talking about that Mercedes, multiple mm-hmm. chopper electric drone thing that was at Frankfurt.
Right.
So
will those types of taxis take off? Ooh, that was terrible.
No.
I kind of like, I've seen the idea where you've got rolling chassis and you've got passenger modules and you've got the flying thing can fly over and drop.
So that Airbus thing that they showed at Geneva.
Yeah, that thing was I kind of like that idea, mm-hmm. you know.
It reminds me of what was that boat car? The
Amphicar?
I forget. The one guy that had the boat car.
Oh, the Aquata.
The Aquata.
Recent one.
One of the problems you ran into with the Aquata is that you have to actually get marine certification and automobile certification for that car.
Mm-hmm.
When we start talking about stuff that flies, now you're going to have to get the FAA certification. Those things have, like, every 1,000 hours, you have to do an engine overhaul. You know, I mean, that's why those planes last forever. Because there's so much maintenance. Every 100 hours, you have to have something. Every 500 hours, I think you have to have an inspection. And that's just of running time. Every 1,000 hours, you have to replace everything in the engine. No, we're never going to have that stuff. It's stupid. I mean, it's nice to dream, but don't dream stupid dreams.
See, I just sort of wonder, I mean, we were talking earlier about autonomous vehicles, and so basically you're dealing with two dimensions. But if we're talking about autonomous drone taxi things, we're talking three dimensions, right?
And then they must be autonomous. I really don't want the drunk, distracted pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not interested in that even a little bit. And I guess,
or a non-fit and proper driver per the London TFL.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little more bullish on
if we're talking about autonomous
those electric
taxi
vertical
things.
Takeoff things than I am all of the winged rotable airplanes mm-hmm. that we've seen. You know, the Terrafugia and the
right.
you know, the one that was just at Frankfurt and
right.
whatever.
Those are just ugly planes.
Well, in every place that the plane requirements and the car requirements conflict, the plane ones always have to win.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
So
the final question, and then we'll get out of here. This goes back to the Dyson discussion. Brandon Gray says, if Dyson can make an EV car, doesn't that show that Tesla is nothing special?
Let's see Dyson's car. I mean, if it makes Tesla's car look like nothing special, then so be it. I mean, that'd be a tall order because those are pretty special.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla is a great battery maker that dabbles in cars. And, you know, they want to sell the batteries ultimately. I think that's always been the game plan for them.
So not to be a car company, but to be a battery supplier.
That also has cars.
To show off the batteries?
Yep.
Yeah, cult following for those cars, though, because the cars are
so
interesting and that cool.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, well, we are at the top of the hour, and Scott Burgess, I want to thank you for making your triumphant return here to AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you very much.
Wish you all the best in your pursuit of the PhD. And,
yeah, well, I'll come back on when you call, and you'll have to call me doctor. Dr. Burgess.
A good doctor.
Hair professor.
Hair doctor. Mm-hmm. Professor.
Frank Marcus, we certainly hope that you're near the end of your ongoing travels here. And
a little respite coming in 2 weeks.
A little respite, and you've been hard at doing the analyzing vehicles for your January
of the issue. Years, yes. Stay
of
tuned
the
for January issue.
The January issue, and you guys are going to have a big celebration announcing these things
in
November.
That's right.
Car of the year.
Yes.
Truck of the year. And
SUV,
SUV of the year.
Yeah.
Person of the year.
And
of the
Pody.
Year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't forget Pody.
I forgot about Pody.
That was always Scott's duty while he was there.
Okay. Lisa does that now.
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
Well, she ghostwrites for Angus.
And so join us next week. We were talking about Mazda rather extensively here. We're going to have Robert Davis from Mazda will be in the studio. And well, I'm sure we'll be talking about all manner of things engineering, since he's rather gearhead-oriented, which is always a good thing. So
I wish I could come back, but I'm en route from Valencia.
See, driving another car. So, okay. So I want to thank you all for joining us. And again, we'll see you back here next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.